Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. And I welcome you. We're going to talk about cancer, cholesterol, diabetes, all being positively impacted by a simple, well, a substance that has been used in Ayurvedic medicine for a long time. Some of you are probably consuming it in your vitamin C, and I'll tell you about that. Also, we're going to talk about how kimchi can reduce the risk of skin problems and how the scenery, not just greenery, but the scenery has an impact upon health. And the omega-3 fatty acids can play a role in bipolar disorder, that's from Penn State University, and how weight loss reverses diabetes from Newcastle University. We have a lot of original, always quality, scientifically based, peer-reviewed journal published articles, and we share those with you each day. In addition, today, I'm going to share an audio clip from a rarely heard JFK speech about truth and about secrecy and why we should not become a secret society. We should be open and transparent. Then I will share some commentaries from John Whitehead from Op-Ed News on the tyranny of the American police state. Also from Victor Wallace from Global Angst Over U.S. Secrecy Fetish. And then from Chris Hedges, Corporate Capitalism is the Foundation of Police Brutality and the Prison State. And then, if time permits, also want to share with you a rarely heard talk called Love Liberates from Maya Angelou. I interviewed Maya Angelou with her book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and after that, several other times. We had many conversations. I was working on my book, Black Hollywood, at the time, The History of the African-American Experience in Hollywood, which was the first book to document that. And I had spent years in Harlem every day working, studying, interviewing. We didn't have computers then, so I had to use the County Cullen and the Schoenberg collection. And I found her to be a remarkable voice. And so came across this, I thought you would find it a very intimate look at how she dealt with her own mother in her life. So that's what we're going to try to get to today. Always I have more here than what I can get to, but we'll see what we can do. Let's begin with an Ayurvedic berry. Now, I've been using this berry for probably 20 years, and I had to get it through special formula because it just wasn't available anywhere. It's called Amla, A-M-L-A. Now, look at your vitamin C. Some of you, I know, will have Amla in it. Others, you should try to get it. Why? Because this particular product, which is known as Emblica, E-M-B-L-I-C-A, officinalis, it's also called the Indian gooseberry, and it's been used for a long time in ancient Ayurvedic systems, thousands of years. It's very rich in vitamin C and vitamin A, B1, B5, B6, really good in magnesium, potassium, calcium, copper, phosphorus, manganese, zinc, and selenium. Now, it's used there either by itself or with other herbs to help prevent many ailments, cancer, even the common cold. We know scientifically that it's a strong anti-inflammatory. It reduces the fever, and it supports liver and digestive functions. It's a natural diuretic, a laxative, and it has what are known as restorative properties. And in fact, a paper authored by researchers from a major college in India entitled AMLA, it looked at what it did with cancer, and quote, preclinical studies have shown that AMLA possesses analgesic and antherogenic, adaptogenic, cardioprotective, gastroprotective, anti-anemia, anti-cholesterolemia, HEPA-protective, and neuroprotective properties, meaning it's good for the brain. Plus, it also helps with cancer. It also helps slow free radicals by grabbing them, and it helps with diabetes, immunity. In fact, here's one, what it says on immunity, quote, AMLA can serve as a key plant ally at the in the autumn when there's a change of seasons, and that's where a lot of people come down with colds and flu symptoms. It contains large quantity of vitamin C, known to boost the immune system. Just one cup, which is about 150 grams of the berries, contain a staggering 69% of the recommended daily intake of vitamin C. And it stimulates T cells in the body. It also helps lower cholesterol. So, that's just something you may not have known about that you can start to include if you care about your health, and I know you do. And just write down the American name is AMLA, A-M-L-A, or gooseberries. We know a lot about the omega-3 fatty acids. There are thousands of studies on them. This is the latest from Penn State College of Medicine, published in Bipolar Disorders. Quote, there may be a link between the levels of omega-3 fatty acids and bipolar disorder. Researchers compared people with bipolar disorder and people with without the mental illness. The team determined plasma concentrations of 5 polyunsaturated fatty acids and 2 saturated fatty acids and 2 monounsaturated fatty acids. And what they found were those who had a good level of the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, you can get that from fish, or if you're vegan, you can get it from flaxseed, hemp seed, walnuts, avocados. There are other sources. And that's good. And that can help you if you suffer from what they're calling bipolar. From Newcastle University, published in Diabetes Care, they did research and found that when you are restricting calories, and it's easy to restrict calories, first get away from the idea that you should feel full when you eat a meal. Ideally, you should feel about 75% full, meaning you can still eat. There's still some hunger, but you don't. And then in time, reduce the portion size of a meal down. People are surprised at how small the portions I eat are. And it doesn't matter what time of year, how I'm training. And I'm always training. I'm training right now for some state championships coming up and in different distances in track and field. And my normal body weight at 2.3% body fat is around 190 pounds. And that's ideal for me. And I have been a lot thinner. And if you look at some of the photographs on my website, at one point, I actually hit a staggeringly low 157 pounds. I was very fast and running. And but, man, I didn't look good. And any time a runner tells you, hey, you look good, everyone else thinks you're near death. So I found that was not ideal. But then I ran for 20 years at 170 pounds. And that's when I was doing marathons, lots and dozens and dozens and dozens of marathons. I'm only going to do the New York City Marathon next year. And by the way, when someone asked me this past week, I was in the park doing my workout, went around 12 miles, and the person said, oh, I didn't see him in the marathon. Are you doing him anymore? I said, not recently. And he said, why not? And used to do them all the time. I said, well, when I started doing marathons, it was just after the first New York City Marathon. I think I started the third one. And then I enjoyed the experience of the training with all the athletes. And I loved doing the first of marathons because I got to visit a city and see its uniqueness, whether it was the London Marathon, the Los Angeles Marathon, the San Francisco Marathon, the Marine Corps Marathon in Washington, D.C., the Montreal Marathon, the Waterfront Marathon, the Jersey Shore Marathon. I did these first, meaning the first one they ever did. And it was a great experience, especially when you're traveling with a whole group of people. We went to London. There must have been 40 of us who went over. And then we spent the week going out and seeing the tourist attractions. But after you've done over 50 marathons and bringing back a lot of fun memories, then you've done it, and unless there's some reason you're going to, you know, do it again, and I've done over 20 New York City marathons, you know, you go on to something else. You do something else. That's where it's at now. And I'm sure that's similar for other people, but to do it for the first time is wonderful. So if you've never trained for a marathon, I highly recommend it. In any case, one of the things that you learn to do is you take a look at the food you're eating and ask, do I need this much? What's in this food that's going to benefit me? Well, whether it's a beverage, a smoothie, a juice, or a soup, salad, entree, dessert, it shouldn't just be that it tastes good. It should be good for you. And hence, last night, came back from seeing a film on Truffaut and Hitchcock, which is okay, and had a berry juice. In there I put blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, some fresh squeezed apple juice, fresh juiced apple juice, and some ice. It was a delicious refresher because I still had about another 4 hours of work to do, and that gave me the energy. The berries in there and the apple skin are going to help with my skin, my brain, turn off free radicals, that's anti-inflammatory, help with cleansing the dead cells out of my body, help rejuvenate cells. So it was not just tasty, but it actually provided health to the DNA. Now compare that to where in the evening someone has a cola or a milkshake or coffee, all of which are bad, and actually destroy cell, cause inflammation. So one turns off inflammation, one turns on inflammation. One's loaded with sugar, the other has nothing but natural sugars, which don't impact negatively the metabolic factors in the body. One contributes empty calories, and hence you're going to get fat. The other provides relatively small amount of calories that the body will use. One has healthy fibers, the other has no fibers. So you see, it does make a difference. So when it comes to eating, if you still want to be eating a lot, then eat salad. Eat starchy vegetables. Eat root vegetables. Eat cruciferous vegetables where you can chew and chew and chew. And parsnips and kohlrabi and rutabaga and persimmons and or parsnips. And then have big salads with lots of sweet onions and fresh garlic and tomatoes and sun-dried tomatoes and hummus. And by the way, Ben Carson, what a goofball. This guy could not distinguish between Hamas and hummus. And I'm listening, I'm thinking, this is the guy who wants to be present, and he thinks our enemy in the Middle East is hummus? No, hummus is pretty tasty, really good for you, and it's not the enemy. Hummus is not to be feared, Ben. But then again, this is a guy who believes that dinosaurs and people all got on Noah's Ark together. How did that work with Trinosaurus Rex? And you realize this is the man who's going to tell us about global warming. He doesn't believe in it. Or science. In any case, eat that which your body actually benefits from. And then you'll reduce calories. And when you reduce calories, that reduces your risk of type 2 diabetes. That's why overweight and diabetes go hand in hand. And proper weight and diabetes rarely exist. Now, there's an herb. It's called sage. It's good in soups, especially bean soups. And the word sage brings to mind kind of the elderly dispenser of wisdom, the fragment brush of a desert landscape, perhaps the smudging of Native American ritual involving burning dry bundled herbs which is said to benefit a location's energy. However, sage is most commonly known as a seasoning, generally around holiday time. Sage takes its name from the Latin word salvere, which means to save, referring to the herb's healing powers. There's a lot of good that sage does. It is an antioxidant, it is anti-inflammatory, it's antifungal, so it's good for people with candida, and it's antibacterial. It's known to reduce pain and inflammation, and especially the oils from which aromatherapy is used. In fact, there was an 8-year study that found sage oil inhaled and applied to the skin was effective in reducing the pain of childbirth. And very good as an anti-inflammatory because it's due to what is called ursolic acid that is in the sage. And so if you have pain, then look at that. It's been used as a throat spray, and with a 15% extract, it significantly, against the placebo, diminished throat pain. And it can help stop hot flashes and ease stress. And that was in one study. And it supports a healthy blood sugar level. And that was in the British Journal of Nutrition. It concluded that sage enhanced insulin sensitivity in liver cells of healthy animals. And it fights lymphoma and leukemia. Now that's maybe surprising, but it's true. A study utilizing cultured human lymphoma cells and leukemic cells revealed that sage extracts suppressed proliferation by more than 80% in comparison to a chemotherapy drug. It's good for your memory also, and it's been used for centuries for memory. There was a trial of 20 people over the age of 65 found that sage, against a placebo, enhanced memory in those who used the extract. It also was given to 42 patients with Alzheimer's disease. 60 drops of sage extract per day was associated with better cognitive function compared to a placebo after 16 weeks. So the takeaway message is that we have one more wonderful, natural, non-toxic herb that we can add into our healthcare system that will make a difference. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. On my back burner of projects I'm going to do when I get through with the current 13 or 14 major films is I'm doing the life story of Jackie Wilson. And I've written it, just have to put the time in to do it. I think he's one of the greatest entertainers, personalities, and voices in history. And he was not dealt with fairly. And that'll all be told in that story. In any case, here is the number you should be writing down and keeping in case there's any reason that you're out and traveling about, and everyone now has portable listening devices. You can always listen to this program. It's on every day. We broadcast at noon Eastern Time, and then it's taken to all the different stations that syndicate this around the country and around the world and play it whenever they want. So here it is. Write this number down, please. Listen live at 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Now, for our sister station in New York City, WBAI, for the listeners there, make sure you take that number down because there is a possibility that in the near future they will be forced to say goodbye to me because of litigation that I will probably be bringing against the national board, including members of the local board, based upon evidence that I have uncovered that I believe is so important that if they do not choose to make changes based upon the evidence presented, and I've given them multiple opportunities to do so, my attorneys, a team of attorneys, have sent them letter upon letter. They have refused to acknowledge the letters. They haven't communicated. It's as if they're defiant, as if, yeah, go ahead, sue us. With me, friends, you don't want to say that. I don't bluff. I have the resources, the research, and I'm like the IRS. By the time I go after you, I got you. So trust me, Pacifica. Trust me, BAI. Everything I need, I have. The affidavits, the evidence, the hard evidence, everything. The audience will be shocked beyond belief if they see what I have. So there's almost a definite probability that when the lawsuit goes forward, I'm giving them a drop-dead date to make change. If they don't, then that next day they're served. And I mean, a lot of people are going to be served, probably over 50. And this goes back a while. And then at the same time, we'll be approaching some major federal agencies. And there's a very good possibility some people will go to prison. So they're not going to keep me on the air. So now you can say, okay, that's fine. It won't impact me, but it will impact them. So if you don't hear me, at least you know why. And because I'm standing up for the listener, something that should have been done a long time ago by a lot of different people who chose not to, for whatever reason. So write down 712-775-6850. And if you forget that, call my office and they'll tell you how to listen. 646-926-5422. Let's hope that reason and responsible fiduciary mindset intervene and do the right thing. Because if not, BAI is finished. It is insolvent. It is bankrupt. And it cannot exist. And the people in power don't want it to. They want to see that it goes bankrupt so they can profit from it by selling the license. They think they're smart. They think that's what they can do. Trust me, that'll never happen. Because those people responsible are going to be in litigation and not just civil. And then let them see what happens in discovery and depositions, because that's where you nail them. And we will. And I don't have to guess what the evidence is. We have it in hand. Lots of it. So just a little heads up, okay? Because otherwise people say, what would happen? Oh, I didn't write down that number. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be listening. Let's go now to some other issues. This is the game. The whole idea of having a group of people join together at a conference to do something about climate change when many of the sponsors for the conference are the very industries that are doing the polluting means that nothing that is mandatory is going to come out of it, and anything voluntary is worthless because no one is going to change the industries, the coal industry, the oil industry, the hydrofracking industry that causes the pollution, the animal industry. They're not going to stop producing animals, which create massive amounts of methane gas. So they'll make promises. They'll come afterwards in press conferences. We've met, we're very much in alignment, and we believe that the... all nonsense. But it gets worse in the United States. According to Common Dreams, quote, uncertainty sown, why Americans don't care enough about climate change. And there was a poll by the ABC News and Washington Post published just yesterday that showed the number of Americans who say climate change is not a problem or doesn't exist is now getting up there. It's over 43%. That's almost half of Americans. Why? Here's the evidence that was just reported in Nature Climate Change, just published yesterday, the latest report by author Justin Farrell, who works as a professor of sociology at Yale University, uncovered a web of 4,556 individuals with overlapping ties to 164 organizations that promote climate denialism. At the helm, ExxonMobil and the Charles and David Koch Family Foundations, quote, emerges the most significant sources of funding for these skeptics. That's according to Bloomberg reports. And so the people who are putting the money out there to say climate change doesn't exist, if it does not by humans, we don't have to worry about it, don't worry. There are thousands and thousands of individuals on the payroll, and that's all they do all day long. So needless to say, if they're pumping out stories and that they've hired academics and scientists to be associated with it, then it's very easy for a person using their prestige or their position to confuse the public or to cause the public to feel, well, it can't be that bad. It is. So now we know there's an army of people who are there to propagandize to make you think climate change is not a problem. I'll be doing a one-hour special on them, their backgrounds, who they are, naming them, and profiling them on an upcoming program. Google is spying on 40 million K-12 students. Privacy advocates call for federal sanctions, by Steven Rosenfeld from Alternet. Quote, unlike its website declaration, Google's Apps for Education isn't a tool that schools can trust because it is spying on 40 million K-12 students and compiling all their online activities, even though it pledged not to do that, according to online privacy advocates. Google is violating the student privilege privacy pledge in three ways, says Electronic Frontier Foundation, in a complaint filed with the Federal Trade Commission. First, student personal information in the form of data about their use of non-educational Google services is collected, maintained, and used by Google for its own benefit unrelated to authorized educational or school purposes. Second, the Chrome Sync feature of Google's Chrome browsers turned on by default on all Google Chromebook laptops, including those sold to schools as part of Google for Education, thereby enabling Google to collect and use students' entire browsing history and other data for its own benefit. And third, Google for Education's administration settings, which enable a school administrator to control settings for all program Chromebooks, allows administrator to choose settings that share student personal information with Google and third-party websites. Isn't this the same Google that settled for $22.5 million civil penalty to settle the Federal Trade Commission's charges that it misrepresented to users of Apple's Inc. Safari Internet browser? And, same Google. So just be aware, if you're a parent, everything your kid does, everything they transmit, everything they collect, Google has it. And that's not cool. From our environmental segment today, this is from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Quote, scientists monitoring the spread of radiation in the ocean from Fukushima nuclear accident report finding an increased number of sites off the U.S. West Coast showing signs of contamination from Fukushima. This includes the highest detected level to date from a sample collected about 1,600 miles west of San Francisco. And this was the radioactive cesium isotopes in the sample. So, here's what you should know that the government is not telling you. All those tens of thousands of mammals, the different whales beaching and dying, the fish with cancers, all the different radioactive elements that are in the sea chain, 100,000 gallons of radioactive material coming out every 24 hours into the ocean. It's reached the west coast of the United States. The people of California have not been informed of this. The argument will be, and I promise you this is exactly what they're going to say, well, there's some small level of radiation that has been detected, but far below that which would pose any harm to humans or to mammals or to the sea life, so therefore go ahead and have your shrimp and oysters and salmon. Don't trust them. I remember long ago, interviewing at the very beginning of my career, Professor John Goffman, he was considered the leading authority of radiation and its impact upon health in the world. He also was the man who discovered plutonium. And he said, any amount of radiation is toxic. There is no such thing as a safe dose of radiation. So just keep that in mind. And those of you who live in California, among other things you should be concerned about. And also, I'm very concerned that we must do more to let our legislators know that they cannot pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even though they've given the president fast track. And now we're collecting data on how much they were paid, your legislators, our legislators, by different special interest groups to pass that legislation. This is from Common Dreams. This World Trade Organization ruling is perfect example of how big trade deals trump democracy in a move that watchdogs say presents a, quote, glaring example of how trade agreements can undermine public interest policies. The World Trade Organization ruled yesterday that the U.S. can be forced to pay $1 billion every year by NAFTA partners for its establishment of food safety laws. In its decision, the World Trade Organization authorized $781 million from Canada, $227 million from Mexico, and annual retaliation tariffs over the U.S. law requiring country of origin labels for certain packaged meats, which safety, food safety and consumer groups, myself included, say is essential for consumer choice and animal welfare, as well as environmental and public health. The United States' North American trade partners argued that being forced to label where animals were born, raised, or slaughtered placed an undue burden on livestock producers and processors, and ultimately persuaded the World Trade Organization that the law accorded unfavorable treatment to Canada and Mexico livestock. So then they turn around and they say, hey, you're going to have to get away with all those labels, just undo them. So how do we know where the animal was raised? You don't. How do we know how it was treated? You won't. How do we know that the animal was eating healthy? We're not telling you. How do we know how the animal was slaughtered? It's none of your business. All of our protections for meat eaters are now thrown out because the United States will not pay $1 billion in order to protect it. So the NAFTA partners. So just keep in mind, that's just the opening salvo of what you can expect with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where all protections of our water, our food coming in from any country, our environment will all be completely stripped bare by all the different treaties now going through. So keep that in mind. And this is for men and women, but mainly women in the audience, who believe, as many do, probably the majority, that mammograms are important because it will tell you if you have a tumor and that could save your life. Well, I would certainly support mammograms if there was a way of presenting you with information that you have a mass forming and that it was also at the same time producing no adverse effects to you. There was no downside. But the trouble is, you've been lied to. And Dave Mihalovic of Prevent Disease did some investigating on this. And this reminds me of a report that I did back in 1975 on this very same topic. This is the latest. This is the title. I'll post this today. It says, mammograms send women to their deathbeds faster and increase their risk of breast cancer by as much as 30%. Mammography is the most widely used screening modality for breast cancer, and with good reason, for the medical community. It gives them more patients. Breast cancer screening results in an increase in breast cancer death and fail to address prevention. Diagnosis of cancers that would otherwise never have caused symptoms or death in a woman's lifetime can expose a woman to the immediate risk of therapy, such as surgery that can deform them, toxicity such as radiation, hormone therapy or chemotherapy, and or late lymphedema. and the late effects of therapeutic radiation, meaning new cancers, scarring, and cardiac toxicity. Now, although the specific plan of oncologists is usually to recommend tailored treatments according to tumor characteristics, there is still no reliable way to distinguish which cancer would never progress to an individual in an individual patient, and consequently treatments are lumped into the treat-all just-in-case category. Breast cancer screening does not play a direct role in the reduction of deaths due to breast cancer in almost every region of the world. Part of the failure correlates to more than 70% of mammograms detecting tumors being false positives, leading to unnecessary and invasive biopsies and subsequent cancer treatments such as radiation, which itself causes cancer. And more than half result in overdiagnosis. Out of all breast cancers detected by screening with mammograms, up to 54% are estimated to result of overdiagnosis, and the best estimates of overdiagnosis come from either long-term follow-up or screening or calculation of excess incidence in large screening programs. Despite no evidence having ever supported any recommendations made for regular periodic screening and mammography at any age, malicious recommendations from the Society for Breast Imaging and the American College of Radiology on breast cancer screening are now promoting that breast cancer screening should begin at age 40 and earlier in high-risk patients. Published in the Journal of the American College of Radiology, the recommendations released by the group state that the average patient should begin annual breast cancer screening at age 40. They also target women in their 30s if they're considered at high risk. On average, 10% of women will be recalled from each screening examination for further testing, and only 5 of the 100 women recalled will have cancer. Approximately 50% of women screened annually for 10 years in the United States will experience a false positive, of whom 7 to 17% will have biopsies. The risk of cancer increases as much as 30% in a given 10-year period for women being exposed to yearly mammograms. Now, 6 to 46% of women with invasive cancer will have negative mammograms, especially if they are young, have dense breasts, or have mucus or lobar of the rapidly growing cancers. And radiation-induced mutations can cause breast cancer, especially if exposure occurs before the age of 30 and is at high doses, such as from mantle radiation therapy for Hodgkin's disease. And the breast dose is typically 2 VU mammograms and with approximately 4 MSVs. And the rate of advanced breast cancer for U.S. women 25 to 39 years of age nearly doubled between 1976 and 2009, a difference too great to be a matter of chance. What could have made the difference, all of these women ending up with advanced breast cancer? Well, take a look. That's when mammograms were being promoted for young women also. In 1976, 1.53 out of every 100,000 women, 25 to 39, was diagnosed with advanced breast cancer. A study in the American Medical Association journal found. Now, by 2009, the rate had almost doubled to 2.9 per 100,000 in that age group. That's a difference that cannot result in chance alone. And a disturbing study published in the New England Journal of Medicine is bringing mainstream attention to the fact that mammography has caused far more harm than good in the millions of women who have employed it over the past 30 years as their primary strategy in fighting breast cancer. Titled "Effect of 3 Decades of Screening Mammography on Breast Cancer Incidence," researchers estimated that among women younger than 40 years of age, breast cancer was overdiagnosed, meaning, quote, tumors were detected on screening that would never have led to clinical symptoms, and in 1.3 million U.S. women over the past 30 years. And in 2008 alone, quote, breast cancer was overdiagnosed in more than 70,000 women. This accounted for 31,000 of all breast cancer diagnoses. Now, most mammography-detected breast cancer presents no symptoms in the majority of women within which it is detected, and if left untreated, will not progress to cause harm in women. And indeed, without X-ray diagnostic technologies, many, if not most, of the women diagnosed would never have known that they had anything in the first place. And the journal Lancet Oncology, in fact, published a cohort study last year finding that even clinically verified invasive cancers appear to regress with time if left untreated. Quote, "We believe many invasive breast cancers detected by retreated mammography screenings do not persist to be detected by screening at the end of 6 years, suggesting that the natural course of many of the screen-detected invasive breast cancers is a spontaneous regress," end quote. The authors point out, quote, "The introduction of screening mammography in the United States has been associated with a doubling in the number of cases of early-stage breast cancer that were detected each year. And yet, they noted only 6.5% of these early-stage breast cancer cases were expected to progress to advanced disease. Mammography-detected breast cancer and related abnormal breast findings, in other words, may present natural benign variations in breast morphology, and preemptive treatment strategies, however, are still employed today as a standard of care, with mastectomy rates increasing as they were in 2004. So, what to do? Well, just be aware of what this author has found. The media is 100% supporting breast cancer screening with mammography, but a routine mammogram screening typically involves 4 x-rays, 2 per breast. This amounts to more than 150 times the amount of radiation that is used for a single chest x-ray. The bottom line, screening mammograms send a strong dose of ionizing radiation through your tissues. Any dose of ionizing radiation is capable of contributing to cancer and heart disease. And screening mammograms increase the risk of developing cancer in premenopausal women. And screening mammograms require breast tissue to be squeezed firmly between two plates. And this compressive force can damage small blood vessels, which can result in existing cancer cells spreading to other tissues in the body. And cancers that exist in premenopausal women with dense breast tissue and in postmenopausal women on estrogen replacement therapy are commonly undetected by screening mammograms. So, what is a better solution? Well, you have one solution, mammograms, as long as you know the full story. But I suggest thermography. Now, thermography is a little-known technique for breast cancer detection that's been available since the 1960s. It's non-invasive. It's non-toxic. It uses an infrared camera to measure thermal emissions from the entire chest and auxiliary regions. Cancer tissues develop a blood supply to feed a growing tumor, and the abnormal blood vessels formations generate significantly more heat than the surrounding healthy tissue. The infrared camera detects the differences in heat emitted from abnormal tissue, including malignancies and benign tumors and fibrocystic disease, as compared to normal tissue. There is no physical contact with the patient, who stands several feet away from the camera while a technician takes a series of images. Now, a second set of images is taken following a cold challenge. The patient places her hands in cold water for more than a minute, causing healthy tissue to constrict while the abnormal tumor tissue remains hot. The infrared scanner easily distinguishes the difference, and these images are compared with the first set for confirmation. Now, thermography can detect abnormalities before the onset of a malignancy, as early as 10 years before being recognized by other procedures such as manual breast exam and mammography and ultrasound or MRIs. This makes it potentially life-saving for women who are unknowingly developing abnormalities. It can also take several years for a cancerous tumor to develop and be detected by mammogram. And its accuracy is also impressive, with false negative and false positive rates at 8-9% each. Now, thermography is also an effective way to establish a baseline for comparison with future scans. Therefore, women should begin screening by the age of 25. And although widely embraced by alternative healthcare practitioners, thermography's obscurity is the mainstream means that too many women rely on mammograms as their only option. They're just not told about it. So, just another point of view. Now, I want to play you something from RFK. I think you'll find it of interest. Please listen.
Decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people, for I have complete confidence and the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors, for as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
Ask yourself, how free and independent is the media today? I do not see it. I don't see it in the mainstream, and I don't see it in the corporate liberal media. I don't see it in many of the programs that are supposed to be progressive but are not. And I'm concerned. Our government should be open and transparent. It is not. According to John Whitehead, our government, that is a far cry from George Washington's vision. I would agree with that. And instead of what we ideally should have, or what Kennedy was talking about, the U.S. government has become a warring empire, governed by laws that are rash, unjust, and unconstitutional, policed by government agents who are corrupt, hypocritical, and abusive, a menace to its own people, and the antithesis of everything for which our founding fathers hoped. Mark my words, if we do not push back against the menace of a police state now, if we fail to hold on to the Constitution and our constitutional republic, if we allow the government to remain the greatest threat to our freedom, then one day you'll wake up and you'll find that you're paying a price for the tyranny at home that you chose not to address and the anarchy that it's caused throughout the world. The U.S. has become a corporate oligarchy. I don't believe anyone challenges that who is aware of the issue. Our elected officials, the majority, especially those in the nation's capital, represent the interests of the rich and powerful, rather than we the people. We're no longer a representative republic and haven't been for a long time. As such, the citizenry has little, if any, impact on the policies of government. There are 300 lobbyists for every legislator in Washington, 131 lobbyists just for every senator, reinforcing concerns that the government represents the corporate elite rather than the citizens. I think you'll find that now when we went into Iraq. Who benefited? Who's happy today? The Iraqis? The Afghanis? No. The people in Syria? The people in Libya? No. The manufacturers of weapons, the think tanks that are funded from those weapons manufacturers. That's who benefits. They're happy. The rest? No. Americans are being jailed for profit. Imprisoned Americans in private prisons and jails run by mega corporations have turned into a cash cow for big business, with states agreeing to maintain a 90% occupancy rate in privately run prisons for at least 20 years. Little surprise, then, that the United States has 4% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. The government's tendency towards militarization and over-criminalization, in which routine everyday behaviors become targets of regulation and prohibition, have resulted in Americans getting arrested for making and selling unpasteurized goat cheese, cultivating certain types of orchids, feeding a whale, holding Bible studies in their homes, and picking their kids up from school, not cutting their grass or planting vegetables in their front yard instead of grass. Yeah, this has caused them to be fined or imprisoned. Endless wars have resulted in a battlefield mindset that is infecting the nation. The idea that we need troops to be in there, boots on the ground. Why? And exactly what would that do today that was not achieved in Vietnam, Afghanistan, in Iraq? How did that come out for us? The Department of Justice and Homeland Security and Defense Departments have passed off billions of dollars worth of military equipment to local police forces. Police agencies have been trained in the fine art of war, but not how to handle people who have an issue in their communities. And we've seen the results. It has become second nature for local police, many, not all, to look and act like soldiers. Communities have become acclimated to the presence of militarized police patrolling their streets. Americans have been taught compliance at the end of a police gun or a taser. Lower-income neighborhoods have been transformed into war zones. Hundreds, if not thousands, of unarmed Americans have lost their lives at the hands of police who shoot first and ask questions later. And a whole generation of young Americans has learned to march in lockstep with the American government's dictates. They will anger people. They will protest if you say something is politically incorrect. If you make them feel somehow that your actions, your thoughts, your words are inappropriate for their mind, but then ask those same students, why aren't you protesting our illegal invasions into countries and our support for terrorism? Why aren't you protesting in mass the laws that keep you bound to your ever-increasing student debt? Why haven't you protested the bailout of the banks, but not small businesses and humans living on Main Street? Why have you not boycotted your school until they start to address the fact that we have over 1,300,000 students who are homeless? You are outraged by what people say, but you're not outraged by what our government is doing? Where is the disconnect? Militarized police, shootings of unarmed citizens, SWAT team raids, misconduct and qualified immunity have transformed the United States into a police state. What we must contend with today is the danger of having a standing army, which is what police forces have evolved into, that has been trained to view the citizenry as little more than potential suspects and combatants and insurgents. It is estimated that the U.S. police kill more people in days than other countries do in years. On an average day in America, at least 100 Americans have their homes raided by SWAT teams, which are increasing, and they're dealing with routine police matters like domestic disputes, search warrants. Every 5 days, a police officer somewhere in America engages in sexual abuse. Why isn't that an issue of how police are selected and trained? Because the good police, and there are many, who care about their neighborhood, care about the people in it, care about obeying the law, they're also put into the bad situation of being tarnished by those who commit these heinous crimes. The barrier between public and private property has been done away with. Call it what you will, taxes, penalties, fees, fines, regulations, tariffs, tickets, permits, surcharges, tolls, asset forfeitures, foreclosures. But the only word that truly describes the constant bilking of American taxpayer by the government and its corporate partners is theft. And why aren't we protesting that theft? We should be. Why aren't we protesting the fact that every single email, every single picture, every single text is monitored? In this way, the police state, with all of its trappings, from surveillance cameras and militarized police and SWAT team raids and truancy and zero-tolerance policies, asset forfeiture laws, privatized prisons and red-light cameras, to stingray devices, fusion centers, drones, black boxes, hollow-point bullets, detention centers, speed traps, an abundance of laws criminalizing otherwise completely legitimate conduct, has become little more than a front for a high-dollar covert operation aimed at laundering as much money as possible through government agencies and in the bank accounts of the corporate oligarchy that rule over all of us. Where is the protest on these, college students? Have you not found the courage to protest these, or you're not aware of them? The hypocrisy is palpable. The technologically driven surveillance state has become the fourth branch of government. This fourth branch, the National Security Agency, the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and 15 other agencies, came into being without any electoral mandate or constitutional referendum, and yet it possesses superpowers above and beyond those of any government agency, say the military. It is all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful. It operates beyond the reach of the president, Congress, and the courts, and it marches in lockstep with a corporate elite who really call the shots in Washington. Beware of what you say, what you read, what you write, where you go, with whom you communicate. because it will all be recorded, stored, and used against you eventually, at a time and place of the government's choosing. The schools modeled after quasi-prisons are churning out future compliant citizens. Within America's public schools can be found almost every aspect of the American police state that plagues those of us on the outside. Metal detectors, surveillance cameras, militarized police, drug sniffing, dogs, tasers, cyber surveillance, random searches, senseless arrests, jail time, the list is endless. Whether it takes the form of draconian zero-tolerance policies, overreaching anti-bullying statutes, police officers charged with tasering and arresting so-called unruly children, standardized testing with an emphasis on rote answers, political correctness, or the extensive surveillance systems cropping up in the schools all over the country, young people in America today are first in line to be indoctrinated into compliant citizens of the new American police state. In conclusion, the courts have become corrupt at every level, and they are part of the government-sanctioned tyranny. With every ruling handed down by the courts, it becomes more apparent that we live in an age of hollow justice, with government courts largely lacking in vision and scope, rendering narrow rulings that have nothing to do with true justice. This is true at all levels of the judiciary, but especially so at the highest court of the land, the U.S. Supreme Court. It mocks everything it's supposed to represent. Given the turbulence of our age, with its police overreach, military training drills on American soil, domestic surveillance, SWAT team raids, asset forfeiture, wrongful convictions, corrupt corporations, all of them, the need for a guardian of the people's rights has never been greater. And yet the left, to its eternal shame, said that one person who could have done that and prevented this, Ralph Nader, was a throwback, a dinosaur. Really? Well, how about the readers of The Nation magazine, Mother Jones, and those on other some Pacifica stations? How about taking a look at where we're at today? The real look. Get out of your cloistered and protected environment. Come with me and see the real world and ask yourself, what would have been different if Ralph would have been elected president? I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.